Hey, it's Simon Smart here. We are nearing the latter stages of making our documentary now, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. We've wrapped up most of our interviews, we've recorded voiceovers, shot scenes around the world at some breathtaking and confronting historic sites, places where Christianity has, for better and worse, influenced and shaped our societies. Today we're bringing you an interview from the documentary that we broadcast last year with Marilyn Robinson. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. Perhaps you've heard or read some of her novels like Gilead, Home, or a favourite of mine, Lila, or perhaps her collection of essays, The Givenness of Things. In this conversation, we discuss the beauty, fragility, and the tragedy of being human, exceptionally human.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart.
Some of you may know that we at CPX are hard at work on a documentary at the moment. It's going to be called For the Love of God, and it looks at the contribution that Christianity has made to the West, for better and for worse. Simon, you've just come back from a trip to the UK to interview people for the documentary.
Yes, I'm just back from interviewing people like the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, Baroness Cox, who's a warrior for disaffected and marginalised people, people like John Lennox, Alistair McGrath. And late last year, we went to the US, and we were also fortunate enough on that trip to get an interview with the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Marilyn Robinson.
Yes, I was kind of jealous of this because you got to go on this trip and she's my literary hero. I think she's just the greatest living writer. So she's a professor at the Iowa Writers Workshop. She's written a bunch of fabulous books of essays, as well as this series of just beautiful novels. And actually, the week before, you guys were there to interview her. The person who interviewed her was Barack Obama.
It was. So we said to her, she's on a trajectory. She had Obama one week and us the next. So she's on her way up, maybe.
Yeah, a bit of a hard act to follow, I guess. But we didn't interview her just because, you know, she's my hero and I love her. She's written about lots of things, including science and religion and the idea of human exceptionalism. So this idea that there's something special about humans and the value that we place or that we should place on human life. And that's an important idea for the documentary that we're making.
Yes, a really important idea. So one thing we want to explore is the way Christianity introduces this revolutionary idea of the human person and the value we attach to human beings. And then there's a whole lot of things that flow out of that, things that we really appreciate in the West. So here's Marilyn Robinson talking about the value of human beings and where this value comes from.
I very often start off my classes because I want to encourage my young writers, you know, to value their characters sufficiently to make them complex enough to be credible, and also to value themselves in a way that makes them push toward real authenticity, real originality. So I very often start off talking about the human brain as being the most complex object known to exist in the universe. I don't know how many times I've said that, but you know, you can find descriptions of it in the billions and trillions of connections and so on that are essential to its functioning. But simply that fact, the fact that of all the things the universe has yielded, each of us has this most spectacular development of possibility, which is a human brain. This is a very, really a secular, in a way, account of our exceptionalism. And I'm perfectly happy to offer theological ones, but in this particular moment, secular currencies are more negotiable than the other kind, you know.
Now, your writing, your fiction writing for sure, deeply reflects that sort of value of the human person. Although it's very much within that framework of understanding our failures and our flaws, isn't it?
We have to deal with the fact that we are flawed and that we are all flawed. I think that the idea of original sin is one of the most brilliant that antiquity has yielded. People want to set themselves apart from the evil that has existed in the world and exists now, the sadness, all of it. But that makes them hard, I think, because they act as if it were all some terrible error made by other people that they themselves are not vulnerable to making. And I think real humanism depends on taking the whole history of humankind, which is really something, really a difficult thing. But at the same time, we have to look with pity and we have to look with recognition on all the generations that have come before us and understand that we are as blind as they are.
And there are people today who like to talk in thoroughly materialistic terms when it comes to thinking about what humans are. They're complex machines or just, you know, big-brained animals. I think of a philosopher like Peter Singer from Australia who talks very much in those terms. But hardly anyone lives like that's true, do they? We tend to resist being spoken of in such sort of reductionist terms, don't we?
Yes. We do resist reductionist terms as they seem to have implications for ourselves. I think the cheat comes in when people apply reductionist terms to other people. You know, when people do each other radical and systematic wrong, it's usually because they have reduced people to labor or to, you know, the masses or something like that, and erased away this very difficult mystery of individuality, you know.
What's your response to people who want to put a kind of faith in science to answer life's deepest questions?
I don't think I've ever spoken with a real scientist, as I would say, who would make that suggestion, you know, just because of the kinds of subjects that I have brought up in my career. I've talked with a number of perfectly fine physicists, you know, and they seem to be in a state of sort of aesthetic wonder. I don't think that there's anything in science as we might understand it, you know, in the period of quantum physics and all the rest, that implies answers lie there. Beautiful as it all is, one answer that lies there actually is the fact that people are unbelievably brilliant, and that who knows who will have the splendid idea, you know. People are mysteries and also infinitely valuable in that way.
You once said or wrote that this modern fable, that science has exposed religion as delusional and more or less taken or supplanted it. But why can't science serve in the place of religion?
The way in which religion and science are treated as being parallel and in competition is in the competing accounts that they make of the origins of things. One of the things that I think we really have to bear in mind is that nobody knows what the origins of things actually are. The Genesis narrative, of course, is articulated in the conceptual terms that were available at the time that these texts became accepted written texts. There are people that still dispute the idea that there was a Big Bang, and there are people that rescue the theory by adding all sorts of things to it, like the Ptolemaic universe, you know. I love the Big Bang. I think it's a beautiful idea. But to treat it as if it were more dogma, you know, the six-day creation, I think, is to pretend that we've evolved past the point of speaking in terms that are mythical and metaphorical, and I don't think that's true. Reality is obviously complex beyond our grasp at this point, and probably for 1,000 years into the future, as a modest guess.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. If you've just joined us, we're partway through an interview that Simon did recently with the acclaimed novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson. One of the things that made me kind of fall in love with her as a writer when I picked up her novel Gilead a few years back was the way that she writes about faith. You know, she's not writing Christian novels in any sense. She just writes really naturally about the experience of faith in a way that people find compelling, whether they have a faith of their own or not.
Yeah, there was an interesting article about this from an atheist who was writing in The New Yorker. And he wrote this about Marilyn Robinson. He said, "She makes an atheist reader like myself capable of identifying with the sense of a fallen world that is filled with pain and sadness, but also suffused with divine grace." And he wrote about, interestingly, the fact that when he reads Marilyn Robinson, he gets a sense of what it would feel like to be a believer.
Well, I'm attracted to religion by the beauty of it. I mean, there's no question about that. And the fact that its aesthetics and my literary aesthetics merge. There's nothing accidental about that. I'm glad that I am predisposed to making the case for the beauty of religious thought, Christian thought, because there's a great deal now in the culture that would make it appear very unattractive. And in fact, I think makes it quite repulsive to many people, good people.
And then as you think about what it means for a secular audience to read literature like your fiction that's saturated with Christian belief, what do you imagine that's like for them? I mean, do they tell you?
I get, you know, very, very positive reviews from people who say they are not religious and who publish in periodicals that are not notoriously, you know, oriented in that way. I have only found generous responses. In this country, there's a tendency, which I appreciate, to suppress the awareness of religious difference in a great many settings, for example, my great big university here, as a kind of manners, in effect. You don't hear much religious conversation in the ordinary course of things. Then everybody goes to synagogue or mosque or wherever. But, you know, the fact that this kind of speech is not conventional doesn't mean that people are not religious themselves, don't have religious thoughts, you know. I think that a lot of people are quite dependent on there being some kind of reasonable public conversation that allows of this kind of thinking. I think that the great power of someone like Martin Luther King is that he was able to speak in a religious language that people recognized and felt was compelling, you know.
Now, your novels are powerfully and so beautifully imbued with this notion of grace in some of your key characters. But did you worry when you were writing something like Gilead that people just wouldn't be able to connect with that anymore?
I never think that way. I never think about it. When I was alone myself in a hotel in Provincetown, Massachusetts, began hearing this voice, well, whatever that means. It's not like a auditory, you know, delusion or anything. But I knew this voice, and I started writing from that point of view because that's what I do. I had no idea. It didn't interest me whether or not it would be acceptable to even my editor, for heaven's sakes, you know.
But many of your characters have faith, but it's a very different kinds of faith. They're sort of stamped with the circumstances around them. The faith seems to fit that for the person that holds it. Do you think there are as many versions of Christian belief as there are those who hold that belief?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Although I think that there are certain tests that can be applied that one can use perhaps to judge the authenticity of one's own Christianity. There are things that people are rather inclined to do now, like engage in slander, which I think, you know, is forbidden in a number of places. You know, God is the judge, you know, and how people are religious and how authentic their religion actually is and so on is something no one is competent to judge. But people are asked to judge themselves. And there's a lot of, I think, crudeness and cruelty now associated with Christianity that ought to make certain people think deep thoughts.
One of the effects of your fiction is the sense of this transfiguration of the everyday things of life. I wonder how you see this sort of the ordinary and the mundane and the extraordinary and the glorious relating to one another in fiction and in life.
I think they're pretty continuous. I've had, you know, completely random conversations with someone I sat next to on a train or something that have been as important to me as courses I took in college, you know. I think that how something resonates with one's own experience or illuminates it, there really is no objective scale for these things. And I think that's something people have known since Piers Plowman, basically, you know, that the idea of the sacred really erases away the idea of relative importance or unimportance, you know.
Well, Marilyn Robinson, beautiful to chat to you today. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to Life and Faith with me, Natasha Moore, and with Simon Smart. We hope you enjoyed this interview with Pulitzer Prize winning author Marilyn Robinson. I certainly did, as I couldn't be at the interview in person.
Yes, and not to rub it in, Natasha, but it was pretty fun to be there.
Yeah, well, you did get my book signed, so I may forgive you.
If you enjoyed the conversation today, you can find others like it by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us.
Also, if you want to find out more about our documentary, then you can look up our episode called For the Love of God. So it has Simon, as well as Justine Toe and John Dixon in it, giving a behind-the-scenes glimpse into kind of the premise of the documentary and what it's all about.
Next week, a poet, an historian, and a former lawyer walk into a studio and ponder the question, is the Bible a good book? We'll see you then.